This is Ann Weller with the Triangle Radio Reading Service. During the next 30 minutes, I will be sharing nutrition information with you. This information is selected from the Nutrition Action Health Letter, a publication of the Center for Science in the Public Interest, based in Washington, D.C. The Center for Science in the Public Interest was founded in 1971 by three scientists who wanted to apply their academic training to the solving of social problems. The center's staff conduct innovative research and other programs in health and nutrition, and they provide consumers with current information about their health and well-being. An independent, nonprofit consumer health group, the center promotes honest food labeling and advertising, safer and more nutritious foods, and pro-health alcohol policies. The work of the Center for Science in the Public Interest is supported by Nutrition Action Health Letter subscribers and by foundation grants. However, it accepts no government or industry funding, and Nutrition Action Health Letter, which was first published in 1974, accepts no advertising. The following edition of Nutrition News is intended for a print and visually impaired audience. Please use the information presented in this broadcast in consultation with your personal physician. The cover story of the November 2012 issue of Nutrition Action Health Letter, entitled A Strike Against Stroke, How to Keep Your Brain in Working Order, is reported by Nutrition Action Health Letter Director of Nutrition, Bonnie Liebman. 6 years ago, when 50-year-old Richard Dykema had a headache and trouble seeing out of one eye, he did what many people would do, and he went to work. He had symptoms throughout the day, but he was working at a high-tech company, and he had deadlines, so he was toughing it out, says Richard's wife, Holly. He came home, and we had dinner, and around 8 p.m., he fell to the floor. If Richard or his coworkers had known the signs of a stroke and had called 911 immediately, doctors might have been able to minimize the stroke's damage. Every 40 seconds, someone in the United States suffers a stroke. That adds up to 795,000 strokes per year, and the number does not count invisible or silent strokes. Every 4 minutes, someone dies of a stroke. Though death rates have dropped, strokes still kill more than 137,000 Americans a year, which makes stroke the fourth leading cause of death. Here is what will and what won't lower your risk of a stroke. A typical stroke is essentially a heart attack in your brain. Roughly 9 out of 10 strokes are what are called ischemic. That means they occur when arteries in or on the way to the brain get blocked by a blood clot. The trigger, a ruptured plaque and blood vessels in the brain or neck or near the heart, or a clot in the heart that travels to the brain. The clot can block the blood vessel, or it can break up into little pieces that go all over the body, including the brain, explains Norm Campbell, professor of medicine, community health sciences, and physiology and pharmacology at the University of Calgary in Canada. If the blood clot cuts the blood supply to the brain, oxygen-starved brain cells near the blocked vessel die. 2 million brain cells die every minute during a stroke, causing brain damage, disability, or death. 6 months after having an ischemic stroke, one-fifth of survivors aged 65 or older have trouble speaking. A third of them cannot walk without assistance, and a quarter of them are in a nursing home. Hemorrhagic strokes are even more tragic, says Dr. Campbell, who chairs the Canadian Hypertension Advisory Committee. Hemorrhagic strokes, which occur when a blood vessel in or around the brain bursts, account for 13% of strokes in the United States, but they account for 30% of stroke deaths. One drug has revolutionized the treatment of ischemic strokes. In 1996, the Food and Drug Administration approved the use of tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA, to break up clots and restore the brain's blood supply. The catch? You do not have much time. The FDA's approval is for 3 hours, but our national guidelines allow us to go out to 4.5 hours in selected patients, says Larry Goldstein, director of the Stroke Center at Duke University Medical Center in North Carolina. But what's very, very clear is that the sooner you get treated, the more likely that the drug is going to be of benefit. And that does not mean you have 3 hours to arrive at the hospital. The current national goal is 1 hour from arrival to treatment. But that's extraordinarily difficult to do in many settings, says Dr. Goldstein, who shared the American Heart Association's 2011 guidelines for the primary prevention of stroke. A variety of things slow things down. Among them, a CT scan and blood tests have to be taken. Other potential reasons for the symptoms have to be excluded, and the patient has to agree to take the drug. But the hospital is not usually the problem. The single most important reason people are not treated with intravenous TPA is that they don't get to the hospital soon enough, says Dr. Goldstein. It is not just that people fail to recognize the symptoms. Denial is very important, notes Goldstein. People do not believe that a stroke is happening, or they dismiss it, and the people around them dismiss it. And time is brain, as they say. If you are too late, there are no treatment options available, says Dr. Campbell. It is a true emergency, and you need to call an ambulance. Even if the warning signs disappear, call 911. You might be having a TIA or a transient ischemic attack. A TIA is one of the greatest predictors of having a true stroke. That is one that causes permanent damage, notes Dr. Campbell. You may not need a clot-busting drug, but you do need treatment, often with drugs to lower blood pressure or prevent clots. You do not want to have the stroke and then be treated. A transient ischemic attack is a great opportunity to prevent a stroke. It should not be squandered by delay. Richard Dykema was eventually treated with TPA, but it did not turn things around, says his wife, Holly. She continues, I've heard so many stories about people who go into the hospital and cannot move their limbs, cannot talk, and they walk out of the hospital totally fine. The drug is amazing. Now, TPA may not have helped in Richard's case because Richard had a carotid dissection, which can start with a small tear in the lining of the carotid artery in the neck. That allows blood to enter the space between the inner and outer layers of the artery wall. narrowing or completely blocking the blood vessel. I did not even know what a stroke was when he had it, says Holly. One day, he had problems seeing out of one eye, and it was not serious, so I said, "Don't worry about it. Silly me." The urgent need to treat stroke symptoms has led to campaigns to publicize a stroke's warning signs, which include sudden weakness or numbness on one side of the face, arm, or leg, sudden trouble speaking or understanding, confusion, sudden trouble seeing in one or both eyes, sudden trouble walking, dizziness, loss of balance or coordination, or sudden headache of no known cause. But knowing these warning signs cannot help with strokes that have no symptoms. In these so-called silent strokes, people can speak normally and have normal power and feeling in their limbs, says Dr. Campbell. They do not get the warning signs of stroke, so they do not go to the hospital. Nevertheless, silent stroke causes brain cells to die. And what is emerging is that silent strokes are probably precursors of dementia, says Dr. Campbell. People become cognitively impaired as the burden of silent strokes increases. Scientists used to distinguish Alzheimer's disease from vascular dementia caused by clogged blood vessels, but no longer. There is a big overlap between vascular dementia and Alzheimer's disease, explains Dr. Goldstein. Finding pure Alzheimer's or pure vascular dementia is a rarity. It is not the rule. Most people have at least some components of both. And the number of Americans suffering from dementia is climbing. So is the cost. We're an aging population, says Dr. Campbell. When you look at hospitalizations, physician visits, and drugs to treat strokes and heart attacks, the cost is essentially bankrupting the healthcare system. The answer is not just to get people to act when they see warning signs or to come up with better treatments for strokes. I view these as waiting for a stroke programs, says Campbell. Society needs to be more proactive to prevent strokes from occurring in the first place. And we do know how. We know that people who follow a healthy lifestyle have a dramatically lower risk of stroke than people who do not follow a healthy lifestyle, says Dr. Goldstein. For example, in a study that tracked some 44,000 men and 71,000 women for 16 years, five aspects of lifestyle made a difference. People who do not smoke, who are not overweight, who do not drink alcohol in excess, who exercise regularly, and who eat a healthy diet have about an 80% lower risk of a first stroke, explains Dr. Goldstein. And the risk decreases for each of those lifestyle habits. In the study, a healthy diet meant higher intakes of vegetables, fruits, nuts, soy, grain fiber, chicken, and fish, and lower intakes of red meat, saturated fat, and trans fat. And in the studies on some 257,500 people, those who ate more than five servings of fruits and vegetables a day had about a 25% lower risk of stroke than those who ate less than three servings a day. Those studies were not trials, so they cannot prove cause and effect. It is possible that people who eat healthier diets also do other things that lower their risk. But odds are that a healthy lifestyle means fewer risk factors for stroke. Some risk factors, like age and family history, you cannot change. But of those you can change, one stands out. The single most important risk factor for a stroke is high blood pressure, says Dr. Goldstein. An optimal blood pressure is less than 115 systolic over 75 diastolic, says Dr. Campbell. As long as a disease has not caused blood pressure to go low, that is healthy. The target for people who are taking blood pressure drugs is 140 over 90, notes Dr. Campbell. I would not want those people to ask their doctors to lower their pressure to 115 over 75, he says. So why is lower blood pressure better? As blood pressure rises, all the blood vessels in the body are damaged, says Dr. Campbell. And that causes strokes, heart attacks, heart failure, kidney failure, dementia, impotence, and difficulty walking. Doctors diagnose patients with high blood pressure, also called hypertension, when either the upper number, the systolic, reaches 140, or the lower number, the diastolic, hits 90. Doctors and patients like having goals, goal numbers, but it is not like at a blood pressure of 139 over 89, you have no risk. And at 141 over 91, suddenly you have risk, says Dr. Goldstein. In fact, the risk starts to rise well before 140 over 90. Around 60 to 70% of clinical strokes are caused by increased blood pressure, explains Dr. Campbell. Half of those strokes occur in people with high blood pressure. And half strike those with increased but not high blood pressure. Increased but not high blood pressure is called prehypertension, and it ranges from 120 to 139 systolic over 80 to 89 diastolic. So normal blood pressure is less than 120 systolic over less than 80 diastolic. We use different names, but the reality is that as blood pressure increases, the damage increases, says Dr. Campbell. Here's how you can keep your pressure low. According to a report by the Institute of Medicine, the health arm of the National Academy of Sciences, first, lose excess weight. If you are overweight, losing about 10 pounds could trim your systolic blood pressure by an average of 6 points. They also recommend that you eat a DASH-like diet, which is built around vegetables, fruit, low-fat dairy, and unsaturated fat instead of added sugars, refined starches, and saturated fat. A DASH diet can lower systolic blood pressure by about 6 points. That does not count the drop in pressure from the cut in sodium that's usually recommended as part of the DASH diet. The Institute of Medicine also recommends that you scale back on salt. Cutting sodium in half, which means trimming about 1,700 milligrams a day for the average American, could cut systolic blood pressure by around 4 points. The National Institute of Medicine also recommends that we eat more potassium in order to prevent stroke. Potassium-rich fruits and vegetables can lower your systolic blood pressure by about 3 points. And that accounts for half the 6-point drop that you can expect from the DASH diet. They also advise exercise. Regular aerobic exercise, like brisk walking, can lower systolic blood pressure by 2 to 4 points. And also recommended is the limitation of alcohol. No more than 2 drinks a day for men or 1 drink a day for women can cut systolic blood pressure by an average of 3 points. It is not hard to see the food industry's role in raising our blood pressure. Sodium is added during food processing by restaurants or in packaged foods, notes Dr. Campbell. But both have too little potassium due to lack of fruits and vegetables. And obesity is due to calorie density, due to sugars and saturated and trans fats. The food companies are killing us, but we're not supposed to demonize them. Richard Dykema has not fully recovered from his stroke. "We used to be very active," says his wife Holly. "We used to ride a motorcycle, scuba dive, and hang glide. Now he is in a wheelchair most of the time. Walking is difficult." He was hit on many levels. He has absolutely no use of his arm. His leg was paralyzed, but it's come back some. And he has a communication disorder and cognitive issues. But Holly still has hope. For many years, the theory was that what you see at 6 months is what you get for the rest of your life, she says. "I have been going to support groups for 6 years, and I've seen many people continue to make improvements years after their stroke. You may not be climbing mountains again, but that does not mean that you will never be able to walk out your front door. You just have to reinvent your life." For Holly, that meant joining the Stroke Association of Florida to help other survivors and caregivers in Sarasota and Manatee counties. "At first," she explains, "I barely knew when my next shower was going to come, let alone who would care for Richard when I went back to work." The Stroke Association of Florida offers information on support groups and a local resource guide. "When Richard first came home, I needed a transfer board to get him in and out of the car," says Holly. "A couple of months down the road, he no longer needed that. Then he needed a device to help him go fishing one-handed. How do you open a jar or operate a zipper with only one hand? Your needs are going to change." The Stroke Association of Florida's second goal is to educate the local community. "People need to know about the lifestyle changes that can prevent strokes," says Holly. "And they need to know that they should call 911 immediately. Because waiting to see if symptoms go away can mean the difference between complete recovery and disability." So what else may prevent a stroke? When it comes to vitamin D, the jury is still out, says Joanne Manson, chief of preventive medicine at Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. "A higher intake of vitamin D and higher blood levels of 25-hydroxy D are linked to a lower risk of stroke, she explains. But until researchers test vitamin D supplements compared to a placebo, they won't know if the vitamin makes a difference. There are so many sources of potential bias, says Dr. Manson, who is also professor of medicine at Harvard Medical School. For example, lower blood levels of vitamin D are correlated with obesity and being sedentary, because those people are less likely to be outdoors, exercising, and getting sun exposure that would raise their blood levels. To find out if vitamin D, rather than a healthier body weight or more exercise, or something else about people with higher vitamin D levels, lowers the risk of stroke and heart disease, Dr. Manson is leading the vitamin D and omega-A 3 trial, or VITAL, which is giving men and women either vitamin D or a placebo. Results should be out in the year 2017. There are now several studies suggesting that people who eat more fish have a reduced risk of stroke, says Dr. Manson. However, the trials that randomly assigned people to take fish oil or a placebo have not clearly documented that. Why the discrepancy? Eating fish may replace less healthful forms of protein, such as red meat, and it also tends to track with more physical activity and healthier body weight, and generally healthier diets, notes Dr. Manson. These differences, not the DHA and the EPA, which are the two omega-3 fats in fish oil, may explain why fish eaters have a lower risk of stroke. Another possibility, most randomized trials have studied people at high risk for stroke and heart attacks, and they're often on statins, aspirin, or antihypertensive medications like ACE inhibitors and beta blockers, explains Dr. Manson. And those drugs may work through similar pathways and lower the risk of stroke so much that it may be difficult to see a benefit of the omega-3s. The VITAL trial should clear up the confusion. It's giving 1,000 milligrams a day of DHA plus EPA to people who are taking fewer drugs because they're at average risk. We've reached the conclusion of this month's segment of Nutrition News. The show will be rebroadcast this week on Friday at 11 p.m. and on Saturday at 3 p.m. Please join me for the next edition of Nutrition News, which will air on Wednesday, January 2nd, 2013. I'm Ann Weller, and I'm reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. I hope you've enjoyed the show. This program is intended for a print and visually impaired audience and is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast. So long till next month.